Hello, seafood friends. You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent, bringing you everything from the boats to the boardrooms, breaking down the news, spilling a little industry fish oil, and sharing the sharp market insights you need to know. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. This week, we're heading to the world's largest snow crab fishery, where the 2026 season is already shaping up to be full of drama.
I expect nothing less from the Canadian snow crab season, Lauren. And we've got UCN reporter Barb Dean Simmons joining us on the pod to talk about where the processors and harvesters stand ahead of the April start of the season. And she's spilling the fish oil on how a big order of 5 to 8 ounce snow crab clusters by seafood chain Red Lobster nearly a year ago is still helping to fuel a fight between the two parties.
But before we welcome Barb on, as promised, we've got Undercurrent's EMEA deputy editor, Dan Gibson, jumping on with us to talk about Shrimp Outlook 2026, which took place in Indonesia last week.
Welcome, Dan. So for those that are not familiar with the event, can you just give our listeners a brief recap of what Shrimp Outlook is?
So Jarlatech is one of our data suppliers from Indonesia. They're an Indonesian aquatech company. It's got a pretty good overview of the sector over there. And I think it may have been last year they ran this event for the first time. Back then it was quite small scale. They've done it again this year, single day event, almost entirely catered towards Indonesians.
So in the past, we've had you on the pod to recap events that you've reported from, but you were actually a panelist at this event, right?
Yeah. So for the first time, at least that I can recall, I was brought on to talk to, to some degree about markets. And I'd spoken with Gary the previous night because I figured, with America being so important to Indonesia, I figured they would want to know all about that. But of course, all they saw was the big British flag up behind me. And they're like, Dan, what's going on in Europe right now? So, that took me by surprise. I know that Indonesia does not sell an awful lot of shrimp to Europe. But of course, they grew a spectacular amount, admittedly from a very small baseline last year, because it was all hands on deck to find somewhere that they could sell this shrimp to that the US was now not accepting. So I mean, personally, I think there could be some room for them to grow in Northern Europe, because European shrimp demand last year, consumption has shot up, and imports of shrimp to Europe, it was, I think, up 20% across the whole block, which in a single year, it's just mad. It's like an additional 70,000 tons that wasn't being sold there before. So, I think a lot of Asian countries who feel pressured by Ecuador in the US, they're looking at Europe now and they're saying, well, we're a bit closer. Ecuador has this advantage of logistics and proximity to America, but we have that advantage in Europe. So can we do something with that?
Were you able to talk a little bit about the tariffs?
Yeah, I mean, for them, it was less about the tariffs and far more about obviously the radioactivity contamination, the fact they now have this certification that they have to do, which it's more of an inconvenience than it is a massive burden for them.
Okay.
I'd say probably the biggest issue is they have to now check every container before it goes out. And you're talking about, it takes about 10 minutes to do a pallet of shrimp. And one of these factories I visited, they told me, given the volume they're doing, that means that people who are checking all these pallets for the purposes of the certification, they can spend up to 2 to 3 hours in a freezer, basically, checking all this, which means they need equipment. And not to mention, I mean, the temperature in Indonesia, it's winter there right now, and it's about 25 degrees Celsius. So for me, I was hot and sweating. They are not used to handling, being stuck in a freezer for their whole afternoon checking through shrimp containers. It's an encumbrance, given the volume that they're doing. It's a burden and encumbrance on the labor force there and on their abilities to work in these conditions, perhaps more than it is a financial problem. They have to do it on almost all of them as well. That's the thing I didn't realize. I thought you could, you'd have to test one or two, but obviously the whole reputation of the industry is at stake and they take it very seriously. So I think as far as they can tell, this is the new normal for them. And they were generally very unhappy, I would say, at their government, because there was only one company, BMS, that tested positive for this radioactive isotope. And what should have been a case of the government putting out a statement saying, we take this very seriously and we're going to figure out the source. It's not acceptable. and so on and so forth. Instead, the government came out with a statement saying, well, if it's about the same amount of contamination as eating three bunches of bananas, what's the problem? Which sends the message to the US that, okay, the whole state does not think this is a big deal, so this is a real serious problem. And the backlash from processors there, who, they agree it's not okay to be sending shrimp that's contaminated with, radioactive isotopes. I think it's driven quite a rift between the private and public sector in Indonesia, this incident.
Well, I know you just got back from Indonesia. Are we sending you off again somewhere soon?
Yes, in a week and a half, I'm off to Bergen, going to Frosty, Norway in the middle of March to cover the North Atlantic Seafood Forum.
There are so many events in the seafood industry. You may not be able to make them all, but the Undercurrent team certainly tries. Subscribe to Undercurrent so you don't miss a moment of the news. Now, as we mentioned earlier, Dan is not our only UCN friend joining us on the pod this week. Undercurrent reporter Barb Dean Simmons is also here with us to talk snow crab. The countdown is on until the snow crab season in the Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador kicks off, and things are already getting crabby.
And that means it's time for our favorite fictional seafood soap opera, The Crabby and the Canadian. At least until Bravo picks up the real snow crab harvesters of Newfoundland and Labrador.
If there was a year for a reality series to form based on the Canadian snow crab industry, this might be it. As mentioned, we're still over a month away from the start of the season, but the harvesters, led by Fish, Food, and Allied Workers, or FFAW, and the processors, represented by the Association of Seafood Producers, ASP, are already at odds.
Was there ever a break in them being at odds?
If the end of the season counts, I guess. But at the moment, the dock price negotiation process is supposed to begin in the next few weeks by late March in order to ensure a timely start to the 2026 season a few weeks later. The executive director of ASP told Undercurrent late last week that they plan on following the timeline. As for FFAW, well, we'll let Barb explain where the harvesters stand.
So once again, it's a little bit complicated. So it kind of boils down to the process of setting dock prices. Now, if you remember 2024, the harvesters and the processors agreed on a system that would see a post-season accounting of the processor sales of crab to U.S. wholesale, and that would calculate the average dock price for the season. So 2024, dock prices started at $3 a pound, and in the post-season audit determined that the harvesters should have been paid $3.75 a pound, meaning that they had a nice little bonus check before Christmas for 75 cents for every pound of crab they sold that season. Everyone walked away happy, so we thought. Same process 2025. Beginning of season dock prices were set at 4.97. This is Canadian dollars, by the way. The independent auditor at the end of the season said, no, you should have been paid 5.25 a pound. So your bonus this year is 28 cents a pound for every crab you sold during 2025. But there was a fly in the ointment. The FFAW argued that the auditor didn't assess all of the crab that should have been assessed. So they included only the sales information for 30-pound packs of 5 to 8 ounce crab sections. And the FFAW argued that they should have considered information on all other product forms, as well as the 2025 dock prices that had been paid to crab harvesters in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. In 2025, the Gulf of St. Lawrence harvesters were paid as much as $1 a pound more than Newfoundland harvesters at the beginning of the season. And that didn't sit well with the FFAW. They say that the price-setting system in Newfoundland needs an overhaul, and what that's going to look like, no one really knows right now. There's been multiple suggestions, including a price-setting czar to dictate prices based on market information, basically ditch the price-setting panel that's currently in place that helps mediate the dock prices between the harvesters and the processors, and go with a person who will just look at the market information and say, here's what the price should be. But they also say, the union does, that in all of it, at the end of the day, there should be no more than a gap of 25 cents between Gulf and a Newfoundland crab dock prices. Because that Gulf gap seems to be the big catalyst for much of this angst that we're seeing right now as we're heading into the 2026 season.
Yeah, to make things even juicier, you reported this week that seafood chain Red Lobster is somehow tied up in this mess.
So in trying to figure out where this season in Newfoundland might go, which is, where the world gets most of its snow crab right now, I was talking to a source in the US who on the wholesale side, and what I've learned is that what skewed that Gulf duck price this year and the price that was paid for Gulf crab was a big order from Red Lobster. They apparently, around about the time of the Boston Seafood Show, they did a deal with some packers, processors in around Nova Scotia, around the Maritime provinces, and to secure a solid order for the Red Lobster chain for 2026, they offered a dollar above the going wholesale rate for packers to supply them with as much crab as they needed. I guess they wanted to shore up their order for the year, make sure they had lots of crab on hand to serve up to their patrons. And that, I was told, is the reason why the Gulf duck prices jumped so high at the beginning of the season. Now, in the story I did, I took a look at some charts, and that gap between Gulf and Newfoundland crab sort of narrowed up as we moved through the season into July and August. But that big gap at the beginning of the season was an anomaly, from what I can tell, for this year. And it really, I guess, aided or ramped up the questions and the frustration among Newfoundland harvesters.
Now, a lot of the headlines for this week for snow crab at least focused on what's going on in Newfoundland and Labrador, but there was also an update this week on the Gulf of St. Lawrence snow crab fishery. So what's the latest news there?
What happened this week is DFO had an advisory meeting in New Brunswick Wednesday with the industry, talking about a lot of things, but they one of the sessions dealt with crab and what scientists were seeing and what they were proposing in terms of crab quotas. So the story is basically, and it was kind of what most people were expecting, because we had been hearing about a potential quota cut for months. So Canadian scientists with DFO have looked at, based on their surveys of the crab fishing grounds in and around the southern Gulf of St. Lawrence in late 2025, they're suggesting that the quotas this year should be cut by about 11%. They say the stock is still healthy. But if you follow the DFO precautionary protocols to keep that stock in the healthy zone, you don't want to take too much out of it. So they're proposing an 11% quota cut. And in whole numbers, that means that the overall quota for the Gulf will move from 18,000 some odd tons down to 16,267 metric tons. That means that the quota will move from 18,334 metric tons down to 16,267 metric tons. Now, that's depends on, DFO will make the final decision. The minister will have an official decision on that probably within the next 3, 4 weeks, because that season typically they start fishing first week of April. So we'll know pretty soon. And but in past years, I know that the minister has usually followed the science advice on the Gulf crab. The good news we heard in that meeting was that there's potential for that stock to grow in the next 3 or 4 years, because there's lots of young male juvenile crab in the mix right now. And if they survive, they'll be in the system in 3 to 4 years' time at market size. So there's some good news there in the mix. Just to wait and see what happens with those young male crab. And but yeah, for this year, it's like a little bit of a trim on the quota and the supply from the Gulf.
And these are just a proposal at the moment, so it's not actually officially announced yet.
Correct. It's a proposal. Science basically provides advice to the minister and the industry, and the minister will make the final decision. I'm sure she'll be talking to some folks in the industry as well, and the final decision will come within the next 3 to 4 weeks. The next one in the lineup is the science advisory on the crab for the Newfoundland and Labrador stock, and I expect to see that before the end of next week, quite likely.
Visit undercurrentnews.com to read all of Barb's Canadian snow crab coverage. Do you have anything fun for us before we go?
I'm not sure it gets much better than the crabby and the Canadian, Lauren.
Agreed.
But since you asked, I do have one more thing. An update on the Wild Alaska Sole Association, or as I like to fondly refer to them as, WASA.
Wasa.
So So I got a chance to speak to Frank O'Hara III, the newly elected president of the Marketing Trade Association.
Oh, no. Tell me you didn't greet him with that wasa.
You know I did, Lauren. Take a listen.
Under Jim's leadership, WASA, we laid the foundation. It was a lot of work getting everyone together, getting the association off the ground. And then, you know, once day one started, just doing the research, building that brand, try to find what we can do to bring attention to the Wild Alaska Soul and Wild Alaska Soul Association. So the first years were about the research and building that brand. But moving forward, you know, now that we've done all of that work up front, I'm really looking forward to the promotion phase, you know, putting all of that research to work and drive awareness. And of course, the ultimate goal, increase sales.
So to learn more about the Wild Alaska Soul Association's next moves, check out undercurrentnews.com for the full show notes. We'll include links back to this story and more that we talked about in this week's episode.
New episodes drop every Friday. Subscribe now so you don't miss a single one. See you then.